Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for joining us for today's show. And by the way, this is the first time we're back on live since we did our show in front of a live audience here on Monday night. And I just want to thank all of you who were here in the studio with us for joining us, being part of the show, asking us the good questions that you did. I hope you found it as enjoyable, as interesting as we found having you here. That said, we're going to be in Savannah on October 30th. I've mentioned this a number of times, and our Community Affairs Department told us this morning there's still a few seats left. We'll be there October 30th, 7 o'clock at night. Go to gpb.org/community, and you can sign up. Just reserve a free ticket if you'd like to join us down there. We hope you will think about doing that. Couple other quick notes. Number one, you can, of course, watch us on Facebook Live right now. Just go to the GPB news page on Facebook. And number two, you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Finally, we are getting organized for our election night coverage here at GPB. We're going to be on the air starting at 7 p.m. on November 6th. We're going to do the first hour of our coverage, I believe. We're still kind of tinkering with this, but we think from 7 to 8 we'll be on both radio and TV. And then from 8 o'clock on, as long as I can keep Tom Faust and Robert Jimison awake, we will stay on the air until we have results of what we think will be one of the really most interesting gubernatorial races, as well as all the other down-ballot races. Greg Bluestein, of course, is here, political reporter from the AJC. Before we go on with the rest of the panel, what do we think at this point? Are we expecting this could be a really late night on November 6th?
And I always expect a late night on election night, but I believe the polls, and we have another one we'll talk about today, but I believe them when it says the race is close. I reached out this morning. I reached out to a bunch of operatives and campaigners and party staffers that I know and trust about a possibility of a runoff, because this is the latest poll that shows that. And they're saying, you know, we're sort of, it's in the back of our minds, but, you know, there's still a long 2.5 weeks to go. So.
All right. Greg Bluestein, of course, you see his byline every day in the Dead Tree edition of the paper. And he also contributes throughout the day and the night to the Political Insider blog at Politically Georgia, part of myajc.com. Amy Stockerwald is back with us, political science professor from Georgia State University. It's great to have you back again, Amy.
Thanks for having me again.
Next to you, Howard Franklin, Democratic strategist, consultant, who I always ask you this and never remember. You have any candidates in this cycle?
I mean, I want to see Stacey Abrams become our next governor, but I'm not working on any campaigns.
All right.
And Jackie, Full disclosure.
Okay, thanks. Well, that's fine. Jackie Cushman is back with us. She is a conservative blogger and columnist. A little later in the show, I want to talk about your most recent column, which I read. Which of the platforms did I read your most
recent? Probably on Town Hall.
Yes, Town Hall. I also read on your own website that you have a book in the works.
I do have a book in the works.
And it's got a title on the website.
Well, I just got a new email from my publisher that we may be changing the title, so let's not talk about it quite yet.
What was it?
I'm afraid I don't remember. But it's around the topic of political discourse, or lack thereof, from a civility standpoint.
I am so glad.
So don't throw anything at me, anyone.
No, I have to tell you that later in the show, we're going to play one of the most aggressive political commercials I've ever seen in my life. We're going to play the audio, and it'll be a great time to talk with you about civility in politics, but we'll get to that in a little while. All right, Greg Bluestein, look, on both Monday's show and Tuesday's show, we've talked about the lawsuits over alleged voter suppression. They're being filed by progressive groups, Democratic groups. ACLU has become the third organization to file a lawsuit. And we don't want to, you know, I'm a little hesitant to get into the weeds because we've talked about it a couple times. And also because, you know, at a certain point, people, they either get it or they don't. But it does appear that this is going to remain a partisan battle, in which Democratic and progressive groups are going to try to make the case that Republican Brian Kemp and his apparatus at the Secretary of State's office, plus some county election officials, are trying to keep Democrats from voting.
And this seemed like it was always going to be an inevitable clash because these two candidates have both feuded with each other for almost a decade over these exact same issues. Stacey Abrams starting the New Georgia Project, which aimed to register hundreds of thousands of mostly minority voters, and Brian Kemp being the state overseer of elections. Both of them fought in court long before they ran for governor. And with his runoff victory and with her primary victory, you know, you just knew that it would come down to this, come down to litigation, come down to constant back and forth over voting rights.
You know, Amy, one of the reasons I think that we're paying attention to this, I went back this morning and I decided to go back and read more about the 2000 recount in Florida, the hanging chads, yes, and the election that eventually the Supreme Court decided in favor of George W. Bush. And it strikes me that you really can go back and trace the roots to the very beginnings of voters' apprehension about whether elections are run honestly to that. And then, of course, you move forward to 2016, potential Russian interference. All of this accumulates so that voters might be more susceptible to believing, sometimes with some reason perhaps, that their votes aren't being counted honestly.
I think there's a lot of concerns, and we've got sort of dueling issues that are going on, because on the one side, there's this concern about fraud, that there's people going to the polls who are voting, who are using names of people who are dead, that they are undocumented, et cetera. The evidence, however, suggests that there's really not a lot of that going on, especially not in a widespread manner. On the other hand, there's real concerns about the counting of the ballots, of whose ballot is going to be accepted. And I think part of what's going on here actually harkens back to sort of earlier times with issues of the concerns that are being raised are that it's similar more to sort of the poll taxes and the literary taxes or the literary tests, where you had very subjective determinations of whether or not the ballots would be allowed, and that's sort of some of the issue that's going on with concerns about sort of signature matching and things like that.
Jackie, it is certainly true that Republicans have been concerned for maybe a decade with this notion of voters of ballot security, feeling that they don't want illegal voters coming to the. I mean, when I say illegal, I'm not talking about immigrants.
Not properly registered voters.
Right.
And, not real voters.
Right.
Does that
sound
like
so we have seen
proper voters?
Right. So over the years, we've seen a number of efforts by Republicans to demand, photo ID, always fought by Democrats. Obviously, after 2016, President Trump alleged there were millions of votes cast by people who were not legally empowered to vote. So Republicans, in some ways, you could say, have kind of, you know, they're looking to protect themselves, but they've also opened the door to people's suspicions on the other side of the aisle.
I think there's always been this problem. So I agree with you, but I want to tell you a story. So even before I was born, so in the 1960s, which I wasn't born in the early 60s, late 60s maybe, but my father actually took a year off of college. He was at Emory, and he ran.
Of course, your dad is Newt.
Yes, he is Newt Gingrich, and he ran he was a campaign manager for Jack Prince, who was running as a Republican congressman in North Georgia. And he talks about election night and how important was the safety and security of the ballot box, right? So this is not a new issue. The security of votes has always been really important. There's lots of places you could look. And so he was there to make sure it was going to be transported to be counted, but instead of being transported to be counted, it was taken to someone's home. So he walked up to the front porch in an effort to retrieve the ballot box, to take it to where it was going to be counted, and he heard the shotgun being pumped, and he was told, the votes are good here. And he decided wisely, probably, to leave. Okay, so my point is, this is not a new problem. And I do think there is concern. Pew had a 2012 report out that 24 million records were inaccurate. So 1 in 8 were inaccurate across the nation.
Registration records?
Correct. So not here in Georgia, voter registration records. And out of that, 2.8 million were registered in more than one state. I mean, you can imagine if you moved and you forgot, you re-registered. And then there were 1.8 million that were actually dead but still registered. So I do think, I do think it's really important. I've always believed people should go vote. Everybody that should go vote. I'm thrilled about the great turnout, but also believe we need to make sure that whoever is voting should be voting. So I think there's a fine balance because you do want people to vote, but you can't say, you know, just come up and tell me you can vote.
Howard, there is a concern. Look, voter purges by secretaries or election officials in our state, it's the Secretary of State, are perfectly legal and important to the process. And yet, the last time we had a major purge here in Georgia, of course, it was seized upon by Democrats as an example of trying to thwart people's right to vote.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me just say, I think there are a couple ways to think about this. I mean, during the most recent legislative session in 2018, there were actually a number of legislative proposals that were looking at upgrading our voter system in a statewide manner. And a lot of the discussion, I'd tell you the majority of the discussion was really focused on how technology has changed both voters' approach to the ballot box, in addition to how security has to also evolve to make sure that we're not just worried about folks who may not be registered or may have been purged, but also foreign foreign interests or folks who have access to air gap machines, et cetera, who might, you know.
Air gap machines?
Sorry, you got me in the jargon. Air gap machines are just computers that have never been connected to the internet. And so many of
air gap.
Air gap. Gotcha. That's exactly right. And so in this case, we've had, I can tell you, sitting front row and center, we've had plenty of discussions about cybersecurity as a matter of course for voting machines, less so, and even in these committee meetings run by Republican lawmakers, by the leadership of the state legislature, less so has it been the conversation been focused on folks voting when they didn't have the right to, and more about giving voters and the public confidence in the outcomes of the ballot box.
So, Greg, these latest lawsuits, one of the issues that has emerged from one of the lawsuits, which I do think is of interest to everybody, is that in, first of all, we have 159 counties where each county has its own ability. It can determine for itself how it validates a registration and allows someone to vote. That's one issue. Another issue is that in many places, it's one individual, the registrar, who can determine, for instance, whether your signature, which you put on your registration card, matches your signature from some one individual. And we could perhaps wonder whether there ought to be a bipartisan committee. I mean, that does strike me as being something worth examining.
Yeah, and look, and if you're Brian Kemp's campaign, I guess the word is frustrated because a lot of these issues are locally controlled issues that they're getting criticized for. Let's say early voting. There's lines 3 hours long now in Cobb County. And so I'm looking at social media and I'm seeing all these people, you know, criticizing the state and Brian Kemp's office for that when it's mostly Cobb County thing. And then there's other issues like exact match and that whole debate where it is Brian Kemp's office that's right in the crosshairs. What's interesting to me, too, is how this is playing out on the campaign trail. I just spent 2 days on the trail with Stacey Abrams' campaign, and it is not front and center of her campaign speeches, the voter registration issues. It's certainly something that she throws into her campaign speeches to mobilize the audience, but it's still about expanding Medicaid, criminal justice changes, economy, public school education. But near the end of many of her campaign speeches, she brings it up and says, essentially, there's 53,000 pending votes. Hopefully all of them will get to vote, but no matter what, you go get another 53,000 people to vote just in case. So she's challenging the crowd to come up in even bigger numbers behind her.
All right, so of that. There is one incident, Howard, that was reported. The AJC had it on the front page this morning, and it does strike me as being quite a bit different than the question of exact match or other aspects that people are seizing upon. And that's this strange story where a senior citizen center in Jefferson County put together a group, mostly I think it's an African-American senior citizen center, and they got on a bus to go to the polls to cast their ballots early. And the bus was stopped, and the people on the bus were told they had to get off. They couldn't use the bus. They couldn't go vote. And the justification given by the county officials was, well, we consider this was organized by a woman who's a Democratic county official, and they considered this to be a political activity at a county-run facility, and therefore they couldn't do it. That's the sort of incident which really, really riles up the opposition.
Well, absolutely it riles us up. I'll go ahead and count myself as a member if that's the sort of thing that passes as a rulemaking in counties, whether they're urban or rural. If it was somehow illegal or there was some policy against elected officials of any partisan stripe organizing their constituents and helping transport them to the polls, I mean, we wouldn't have half of the electoral activity we see in the city of Atlanta every 4 years. I think a big part of what we try, and I've been a part of dozens of these efforts, a big part of what we are insistent upon when we organize, particularly these early vote caravans for seniors at senior high-rise centers, of which there are something like 50 in the city of Atlanta alone. We are very careful not to include partisan campaign materials as a part of that transport, and the same laws that apply to anyone who might be electioneering, anyone who might have a preference for how folks are casting their ballots, still apply. That 100, and I think it's 50 feet that you've got to remain from the, you know, from the demarcated point with a sign, still are in place. I don't think there should be any rules that would preclude folks getting help up until you get to that sign.
Amy, what did you make of it when you saw this story?
It was concerning in the sense of what was the reason for stopping it and where are the suggestions of where it would be. I mean, I think what is in part coming up was a question of would the bus have been stopped if the people that were on the bus looked different, or if they thought they were going to vote in a different way. And those are the types of things that we don't want ever want there to be, right? We don't want it to be that we think a bus is going to be stopped if it has a group of older white folks, and we definitely don't want it to be stopped if we think it's going to have a group of, you know, older African-American folks or Latino, et cetera. And so I think some of this is also making sure that, again, it's getting rid of that subjectivity, that concern that you were asking Greg about with the one person making the decision or the possibility that the rules are being applied in one way in one county and one in another, because sort of the concern about the kind of massive decentralization we have with 159 different counties is that you might have 159 different rules on election day.
Jackie?
So I was actually pulling up, Greg, you can probably talk to it better, the reason that they actually stopped, because I do think that's a concern, and part of it is we do have 159 counties, so you have 159 different people making
most
decisions
about—
most
counties in a state east of the Mississippi River.
I know, and that's a whole different discussion about whether we should, you know, adjust that.
Yeah.
No, I mean, that's a whole different—
Where's Killian Townsend when we need him?
Yeah, but I think there was some concern, and it maybe not rightfully, that the Jefferson County Democratic Party chairwoman, Diane Evans, helped organize it.
Right.
So there is the, I mean, and I don't know what the rules were, but, you know, I like to give people the benefit of doubt. Hopefully it was done in good faith. Clearly, we don't want anyone stopped from voting. Everyone should be allowed to vote.
Well, you've got to imagine she was hoping that the people on that bus were going to vote for Democrats.
Well, I said, don't let me tell you the other story about 1976 when Jimmy Carter ran, and there were buses pulling up in Carrollton, Georgia, and trust me, all those buses were voting for Jimmy Carter. This is not a new thing.
And that's what the county said, was there was a vice chair or a chair of the local Democratic Party who was involved. But look, there was video of it. Where there was no overt political statements. It was just trying to energize these senior citizens to vote. And just the image of them being pulled off a bus that was getting ready to go to an early voting site just—
And more to the point, there's nothing that would conversely preclude that same Republican vice chair or chair saying, hey, some of the voters who are here in this senior center, in this county facility, might be Republican voters, and we want to aid their transportation to the polls as well. So I don't think that should be the qualification to your point.
I want to get to our first break, but before I do, Amy, just to finish this subject out, I said this in the note that I shared with all of you this morning about some of the things we'd want to talk about. This is more tribalism. This is not about a search for the truth in most cases. It is a search for a weapon, an advantage to use against the opposition. And as a result of that, I'm hopeful that people like Greg Bluestein and that we on this show, for instance, are able to say, yeah, you know, they're understandable why some people think voter suppression is happening, but here is the reality, what this and this. And on the other hand, we can give the other side of it. But the reality is, this is tribalism at its best.
It is. And there was a really neat study that came out, at least in an intellectual sense, maybe not for the findings, that showed that partisanship has basically become the new sort of community tie that people look to. It's much more like sports teams. It is much more that you view the opposition as immoral or unethical. Mm-hmm. And it's even eclipsing sort of our old sort of ways that we would identify within our community. People sort of see themselves first as whatever their partisan identity is. And I think the concern there is that then leads into sort of other concerns about how we process information, what we think of the source of information, whether or not we're willing to listen when we're given information about something that doesn't match up to our preconceived notions.
The one thing, though, Greg, is to give you the last word on this, is we will get to the bottom. A court, several courts, will in fact rule on these lawsuits. And they will give us some sort of definitive answer about these things.
Definitive might not be the right
word.
Well,
you're
right. And they'll be. And look, this is going to be the 2020 battle and the 2022 battle as well.
That's right.
Back and forth.
All right, let's do this. Let's get a vote. Let's get a break out of the way. When we come back, let's talk a little. Greg, we do have new early voting numbers based on all of yesterday. Let's talk about them. Let's look at the demographic breakdowns and what they may tell us. And also, a brand new poll, and we know how much you love polling out there in our listening audience, and we'll get to that after these messages.
You know, selling a car can be a hassle, but donating it is a whole different story. Let us take it off your hands or off your driveway and turn it into public radio and maybe even a tax deduction. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the host of Marketplace, and here is how to donate.
Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. We have now had two full days of early in-person voting. I mean, we're by now at this hour in the afternoon on Wednesday, half a day into a third day. Greg, the turnout continues to be pretty astonishing. The in-person turnout, and then, of course, adding the absentee ballots, the early ballots by mail, it really is something.
It is something. We had about 70,000 people vote Monday, which was three times more than the same period in 14. And we had even more than that vote yesterday, 75,000. All told, if you also count on the roughly 70,000 mail-in ballots that have been processed, we've got about 215,000 total vote count, which is, again, more than three times higher than the number of early votes cast over the same period in 2014.
So there's a website that Robert Jimison, we ought to tweet this out, georgiavotes.com. There's somebody out there who seems to be doing a pretty good job of keeping track of the data as it comes out of county offices. He has it at around 212,000 people have voted early at this point, as opposed to the last midterms when the number was 67,000. White votes, now that voting has started in person, seem to be higher than black votes. Women are voting at somewhat higher levels than men are at this point. People in the age range starting, 40 to 49 and up are voting in somewhat higher numbers. So what does all this tell you?
Well, it's really hard to read into early voting numbers because we don't know how many of them are cannibalizing the actual election day vote. What we can see generally is that, a lot of energy and enthusiasm. His calculations show that about one third of the voters are new or haven't voted in past midterms. So that's got to be exciting. Democrats who, again, that's the heart of Stacey Abrams' entire strategy.
Expanding the voter pool.
And Republicans are looking at some numbers too. And again, they're not, it's hard to read into these, but of the early votes, they're outpolling Democrats in terms of who also voted in this year's primaries. There's about 10,000 more Republican votes than Democratic votes in terms of who from the universe of voters who also voted in the July primaries.
Yeah, our friend Todd Rehm did some really good crunching on that. Is there a little more from him on that?
Yeah, he also found that roughly 70,000 of the people who voted early cast ballots in the 2016 GOP presidential primary, while 44,000 voted in the Democratic contest. So, that seems to show that the Republicans have an advantage there. And also, a lot of Democrats and Republicans are looking at the numbers of new voters who haven't voted in these midterms. Well, Todd points out that About 15,000 of these newer voters who skipped the past two primaries came from counties that Trump carried by more than 70%. Again, we don't know if they're necessarily Democrats or Republicans, but they come from pretty red counties.
Jackie, what do you make of all this?
So I think a couple of things. One, I'm excited because I think it's great when we have lots of people to vote. Then they can't complain as much about the results, right? They need to all get it. And I know we mentioned it last time, but all those that were still pending can still vote. So please go vote. Secondarily, if you look at the actual registration numbers by kind of minority, I pulled this morning kind of from the Secretary of State's office. Since the last midterm, we've had a 99% increase in Hispanics in terms of registered Hispanic voters. We've had a 15% increase in white voters, 23% increase in black voters, and 92% increase in Asian voters. So you do have a lot more in terms of the growth. Definitely the growth is coming from the minority side. So those, you know, those are also new voters compared to the midterms last time. So, you know, I don't think we're going to know, I think, and we'll talk about the poll later. But my guess is, you know, we're not going to know, and we're going to be, you know, on election night trying to figure out who's actually going to win.
I'll go ahead and go out on a limb and predict that I think, at least at the top of the ticket, that Stacey Abrams will win the early vote. I think we saw this in the special election for CD6 with John Ossoff. I think in large part to what, you know, Greg already mentioned, those are campaigns that are focused on bringing new people to the polls. And one of the easiest ways to do that is to take advantage of that convenience factor and say, hey, you can cast this vote via the comfort of your own home or, you know, riding down to this designated early polling location and casting your vote right now. I think the question is, how large a group is the early vote total, and how big of a proportion will it be to the larger electorate that's cast on election day? But if you look at early voting in Georgia, which is going through its machinations, you know, 6 weeks down to 3 weeks, but, you know, also as we've seen more folks, I think AJC reported now we've got nearly 7 million voters on the rolls today. I think the real question is, how much of this is just people moving to a place that's much more convenient, right? We live in a convenience economy. Everything's on demand, whether it's transportation or content. And I think to some degree, we're all more willing to vote when it fits into
our
busy lives.
So help me with something. And I'll bet you could get involved in this too, Amy. But Howard, I get why you think it might be Democrats voting for Abrams who come out early, because you're talking about getting younger people to the polls. It's convenient. It's instant gratification. But why do you expect that perhaps that margin changes on election day itself? Is it based on, my assumption is older voters tend to vote Republican. They're locked into a habit of voting on election day. Is that really what it comes down to?
I think that's a big part of it. And I think also, you know, having worked in a number of these races in the city in particular, it's harder and harder. I remember in 2005 working for former council member Kwanzaa Hall. On election day, we could knock and drag. There was enough concentration of folks that we knew were our voters that we could go to their doors, tell them, hey, the van's right here. Get in. I'm going to run you around to the polling election or the polling place, and you'll be back in 10 minutes. Now, I think that's different for each of the parties in terms of where their bases may lie, but I think it's also harder, especially you look in Midtown today. That's still District 2. Gated communities, elevator fobs, like knocking and dragging is a lot harder to do. And so if someone's getting up and finding the time or asking the boss for a half an hour to go vote, that's a person who wants to vote on their own. They're less under our influence as operatives in the political space.
Like you want to jump in.
Well, yeah, this has also become an even more essential phase of the election than it was just in the last midterm. Think about this. The last midterm election in the state in 2014, roughly 37% of voters filled out their ballots before Election Day. In 2016 for the presidential race, nearly 60%. And it'll probably be around there this year, too. So think of more than half the electorate votes early now.
It's easier to vote early. You get to go really wherever you want to. And that's actually PSA for everyone. Like, you are not required to stay at your normal polling place.
Let me interrupt that for just a second, if I may. My wife and I vote in DeKalb County. We used to be able to vote early at a polling place that was set up 3 miles from our house. Mm-hmm. That's one of the polling places that has been eliminated. We now have to drive about 12 miles to get to an early voting polling place. So I hear what you're saying, but if we but as counties start shrinking the number of polling places on election day itself, I assume there's also shrinkage, especially in early voting locations.
Definitely. So any of my students who are listening are going to laugh because they know what I'm going to say. Structure matters and institutional design matters. Where we put polling places matters. How many of them are there are and where they're located, how far they are from people, how far you have to drive, influences all of this. Right. It is right now in the United States, especially compared to other countries, much more difficult to go vote. Right. We ask more of people. You have to travel farther. We don't have, for example, a national day off. So that for voting days, we don't do it on the weekend. And so the farther that voting place, especially even early voting places, gets from where people live and gets into questions of, is there parking? Is there a bus route that gets there? If you're out in rural areas, how far do I have to go and how easily can I get there?
You know, Jackie, what I think is interesting about our situation, DeKalb is one example. Here's a county that is reliably Democratic. I mean, there are certainly sections of DeKalb that are Republican areas, but it's reliably Democratic county. And yet, and I've asked this question to Mike Thurmond, the CEO, when he's come in and been on the show. You would think that in a county like that, with a Democratic CEO, they would be doing everything they can to expand the number of places vote.
Theoretically, yes, but then he also has to run. He has to run an organization that has a budget, right? And, and so it all comes down to, yes, if we could put polling places everywhere, that would be lovely. But they have to be manned. I mean, they're not manned by one person because they have to have several different poll workers and they have to be open certain numbers of hours. So there is this, and I'm not saying, but there is this, you know, how can you put them in the right place without, you know, breaking the budget for the county to make sure they can actually get to people?
There's some politics. If you guys remember, Greg, I know you do 2014, when a number of counties under progressive leadership, DeKalb, I think Muskogee, Macon, Bibb, said, hey, we're not only going to increase the number of polling locations we have, we're going to put one in South DeKalb Mall.
Yep.
We're also going to have Sunday and Saturday voting, right? All polls to the souls on Sunday. So, and that there was this. Ended up in the pages of the AJC and a number of other places. Republican lawmakers in particular said, hey, it's unfair that these large, well-funded counties have the resource to open their polling places. Why do you guys get to do it and mine can't do it?
Are you back to the 158 counties? Is that part of the problem?
Right. 159.
Sorry. I'm trying to get rid of one. Just real quick, though, I think most polling places, not all, but some will be open on the 27th or the 20th for weekend voting.
For Saturday voting.
So I'm just saying, if people are out and want to, that is an option, if that place is open.
It's a great time. All right, Greg, let's move on. We've got a new poll. So when we start talking polls, our Facebook Live crowd, some of them say, oh, no, not polling again. Again, this is a snapshot of today. It is not a prediction of who will win the election. And you know what? It's fun. The top line, the horse race number from Reuters, Ipso, is...
47-46 Kemp leading Abrams, which is about ours was, I think, 48-46, but within the margin. Neck and neck.
Yeah. With how many undecided in that one? I forget.
4% as well undecided. So a very small number of undecided this close to the election.
Yeah, but enough to raise the possibility of a runoff.
Yeah, you said the R word again.
Oh, my God. All right, so here's what's interesting.
Can I interject there, Bill? Because I think it's also important to note that the reason that there could be the runoff is not even that undecided vote. It's that... whoever wins has to get to 50 plus point plus one.
Right.
And so if there's any type of third party vote,
well, we have a libertarian candidate.
Exactly. Right.
In the
any
race.
Type of third party vote, then it pushes it toward, especially in a close race, that there's going to be a runoff. So even if they are decided.
And he's been polling at 2% in pretty much every poll, which is within the margin of error. So who knows? But Republicans are hoping, and they're starting to see the numbers of their own showing that his support is tapering off a little bit. He'll probably get 2% no matter what happens, but that could definitely raise the and there's also a fourth candidate who's in the race too, who could get a small sliver of the vote too.
What's interesting to me about this is the I love to look at the crosstab or the other questions rather. So for instance, Reuters asked Georgia voters the most important problems facing Georgia today. What's the most important problem facing the United States today? But these are Georgia respondents. I thought it was interesting that it's not surprising that 18% said healthcare, because that mimics almost every other poll we've seen. But Jackie, that raises this question of whether Republicans may be paddling up the wrong stream if they're not cautious about how they talk about not expanding Medicaid here in Georgia. Brian Kemp doesn't want to expand Medicaid. We think that Congress would, if it's a Republican Congress, would maybe go back and look at getting rid of ACA again. I mean, this is a tough issue for Republicans right now, isn't it?
Except that if you look at likely voters, Democrat versus Republican, Democrats put that at 27%, and likely Republican voters put that at 17%. So there is a split among party lines.
Right.
I do think that it is something that that we need to think about very thoughtfully, because really, in reality, if you don't have a system that works overall, it's bad for the country for the long term. But the Republicans' core belief is that a single-payer system doesn't work because of inherent, it just doesn't work. So you have to come up with a different solution. So if you look on the Republican side, their top concern for likely voters is immigration.
Right.
So I do think this also, that if you kind of look at what's happening with the races, they kind of reflect what the core issues are in both constituencies.
What other numbers in there were? I was surprised. I want to share one with you. Morality came in at 12% of Americans said morality was a big issue for them. And in fact, more Republican likely voters than Democrats picked morality. What is that all about?
This was also interesting when asked about who would better handle these social divides that I guess morality would fall under. Voters gave Abrams the advantage over Kemp. Also, they gave her the advantage on health care, as we just mentioned, education and the environment. Kemp had a slight edge over Abrams on economic issues, which also mirrors the AJC poll, and a wider advantage on immigration and law and order policies. Mm-hmm. So the issues that he's focusing on, he seems to be doing better on. The issues she's focusing on, healthcare is one of them, she seems to be doing better on. And again, that the healthcare one was a little different from the AJC poll. The AJC poll showed both of them neck and neck, but this poll showed her with a clear advantage on the issue of healthcare.
I want to ask you a question about just what you're talking about. A little while ago, you said that you talked about Abrams when you were out with her for 2 days, and you've been out with Kemp, obviously, for tours of the state. Are they both equally disciplined in the way they focus on the issues that they say are the most important? So Abrams, of course, did our show last Friday and was strikingly disciplined. Her message is clear. She knows what she wants voters to hear from her. I haven't been out with Kemp. Is Kemp doing the same thing?
Yeah, he is for the most part. His campaign appearances tend to be a little shorter, his speeches at least, and then he spends a lot of time taking pictures with folks afterwards. But his are much more sharper attacks on Abrams, and that's been like the way since he won the runoff. She's only more recently begun to lace her speeches with attacks on him, and that really rung true the last couple of days. We wrote a story back in August or September saying that she's largely laying off of him. Well, that's no longer the case.
Yeah.
Because guess what? The election's in 2 weeks.
I think there's that. And I think there's also, I think we've gotten a clearer sense of what the battle lines are. Obviously, this back and forth on whether or not, I think, Greg, you laid this out well. Now, these are two elected officials who've operated from underneath the Gold Dome for half a decade now across a certain set of issues. And now that there seems to be evidence or at least enough to charge and allege that there's misdoings from the Secretary of State's office that couldn't just be folly, that wouldn't just be bad administration. I think she's got an argument that most voters understand intrinsically, right? You don't have to, if we're talking about expanding access to the ballot or suppressing access to the ballot, most people don't need you to identify which party might be guilty of which offense, right? And I think that obviously has emboldened her, I think, to press down on this on the charge as opposed to doing what she initially started with, which is, I'm just going to bring more people to the party than you do.
Amy?
Right?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, the other thing I think that's nice, though, is we don't have to determine the policy positions of these two candidates. There's actually been a lot of policy attention given. They both have given very policy-heavy speeches. Mm-hmm. They've given a lot of information out there. It hasn't been as much about the attacks
actually,
and all that.
I would disagree with that. I was on Political Rewind a couple weeks ago, and we were talking about a similar topic as it related to policy. And I actually mentioned this to Brian, who's often on. And
Brian
Robinson. And I went on both of the candidates' websites. And what I found for the Kemp website, because I really wanted to be read up and prepared to have the discussion, was many of the links on the website were press releases or there were endorsements from people who might be leaders on policy.
All right. With that said, Amy, just to go back to you, When I go on the Stacey Abrams website, they list a number of issues and then have very sparse bullet points. It isn't as if they're laying out big position papers. So I'm not sure that looking at what they've got on their website is necessarily an indication of whether they're talking policy.
But the policy contrasts are clearly there, and that's what makes this race, for me, fun to cover. And for voters, a contrast, because we've had elections in the past where the candidates agree on many of the things and disagree on a few big ones. In this one, there are polar opposites on so many of the biggest divides in Georgia, from criminal justice to tax policy, to budgetary issues, to social issues, you name it, guns. And so that makes it, and I think that even if that's not available on their websites, and it probably should be, we spent a whole week last week at the AJC just writing seven stories in a row on seven of the top issues.
Well, and at least as a political scientist, what I'm excited by is that the voters are recognizing these differences, right?
And they really have choices.
They have choices. The voters recognize that there are, in fact, competing and contrasting claims that they're going to go for, and so it's giving them something to pick from. So at least that message.
You want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because I think it's a much closer race. And if you kind of step back and look at the big picture, considering that we're doing very well economically in the state, we're number one for business. We've had a fantastic governor, Nathan Deal. Many people thought when he was coming in, they weren't sure about him, but he's done a great job with criminal justice reform. He's really worked on education. So I think it's really fascinating that if you look at that and kind of step back, it would look as though it'd be easy for Kemp to win. I'm just saying, from a pure, regardless of what he is. So to me, she's a very good candidate. I mean, I couldn't say that a couple years ago about Hillary Clinton. She wasn't a good candidate for the Democrats. Stacey Abrams is a great candidate. But I do think they provide very clear choices. And I just hope that people go through and look at the decisions, because it's a real decision, and I think that people need to be thoughtful about it. And I do get worried sometimes that they get so caught up in the back and forth and the headlines from the media. No, sorry, Greg. It's so easy to get those media, especially for the news shows, for the TV shows, to really dig into what the policies mean.
All right, let's take on one other very quick. Let's do this quickly, Greg, because I mentioned at the beginning of the show I wanted to get into it, and we got to get to a break. The Sarah Riggs Amico is suddenly dealing with this issue that her family trucking business is the subject of a lawsuit filed by 10 or 11 of the employees of the company up in Indianapolis, alleging racial discrimination. I think there may be at least one allegation of some form of sexual harassment. No surprise, Jeff Duncan's campaign, her opponent, Republican opponent, is going after her on this. And Riggs Amico now says, hey, you're lying about me, and you ought to. I'm demanding that you withdraw the allegations you've made. Tell us a little about this.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say this delighted Republicans because it got them to re-air this whole thing because it came from a lawsuit. The Amico campaign is calling on Republicans to retract attacks on her based on this lawsuit. And the other surprising thing is it's not just the Jeff Duncan campaign that's jumped into this fray, but it's also Brian Kemp.
Yeah.
And usually it's not too typical to see a gubernatorial candidate jump into an LG race.
But he's doing a very, I think, kind of a clever ploy. He's suggesting, Stacey Abrams, why don't you tell Sarah Riggs Amico she ought to step down because of racial discrimination? It's an interesting approach.
And if anything, it's drawn, and Abrams has not commented on that, and she is not going to call on Amico to withdraw. But they are also basically almost running on the same ticket now. I mean, at campaign stops all over South Georgia, their names are on the same placard saying, under the slogan, "We in capital are Georgia."
Yeah.
Amico and Abrams.
Amy, before we get to the break, I think Greg said a really important thing. The story broke that the lawsuit had been filed. Obviously, the Duncan people jumped all over it. And then Sarah Riggs Amico's campaign decides to bring it up again, and it's once again back in the news. Not necessarily the smartest way to deal with the issue.
Likely not. I mean, in many ways, it just sort of furthered it and is now getting everyone to go in and to read it. I mean, I think it was perhaps trying in the same way that others have tried to, shoot down claims and say, well, it's just simply not true. It's false. You need to drop it. But I'm not sure that everyone can get away with that type of argumentation.
Yeah.
And really, one quick note, Kemp's campaign did the exact same thing when it was faced with sexual
exactly.
On massage,
over the massage parlors.
So they did it, and there was a whole new cycle of stories on it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Let's get to another break. When we come back, I want to play a couple campaign commercials. They're really interesting. This is Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air, the creator of the Netflix comedy series BoJack Horseman, Raphael Bob Waxberg. BoJack is an animated comedy with a cast of humans and animals. BoJack is a horse who's a depressed, alcoholic, sexist former sitcom star. The series satirizes Hollywood and pop culture, and the new season is set in the era of the Me Too movement. Join us.
A lot to unpack there. Find out more on Fresh Air today at 3 here on GPB.
We're back on Political Rewind. Greg Bluestein is with us today. So is Jackie Cushman, Howard Franklin, and Amy Steigerwald. All right, I want to play you a couple campaign commercials. The first one is a national commercial. There's a lot of money that a PAC called Future 45, which has been around ever since the presidential race and did a series of ads attacking Hillary Clinton. Sheldon Adelson, among others, have been contributors to Future 45. They have now put on a commercial that, in some ways, you have to see the visuals, but believe me, you will, because they're buying a lot of time with it. But as you hear the audio of it, you'll get the sense this is a tough commercial. The video includes pictures of protesters outside the Kavanaugh hearing, some kind of street violence not identified in any way. Michael Avenatti with a line, a big headline on the page that says Avenatti's gang rape bombshell. Other things like this. There's a very harsh picture of Nancy Pelosi with a gavel in her hand looking fierce. So all that said, there's more. Listen to the audio.
The screaming, the violence, the smears, and death threats. The far left moving to socialism. Undefended open borders, immediate tax increases, 100% government-run health care. The booming economy stopped. Nancy Pelosi back in power. Gridlock. And then impeachment. Is that really what you want? Voting for any Democrat gets you all of that. Future 45 is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Woo!
Wow.
Here, and the key line, Jackie, voting for any Democrat gets you
all of that.
All of that. This is about as bare knuckles a commercial as I've ever seen in my career of covering politics.
We're not going to go back to the bomb, the nuclear bomb going up.
That's right.
Were you covering politics with Goldwater?
He probably was.
The nuclear bomb ad ran one time.
Yeah. Okay. Well, they didn't have the internet then, right? So now you can't run anything one time. It was a never-ending clip, right?
But this is bare-knuckle stuff. This is mean.
This is how you draw big contrast. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying this is what happens when you get near the end is you draw very big contrasts and let people think about it. But every Democrat, local elections, state elections, really. I mean, they're really talking, obviously, about the House, and we can get into the structure of government. But they're really talking about trying to retain the House. The Senate will probably get retained for the Republicans. So really, this is really a House campaign ad.
You know what I thought, Amy, too? This ad proves once and for all what other people than us, but we've said on this show any number of times, is forget about the maxim that all politics is local. Not this year. All politics is national.
Well, it's Nancy Pelosi.
Right.
I mean, she is, in fact, the person who's mentioned in the most ads anywhere in the country, more so even than Trump, definitely more so than the current leader of the Senate or the House of Republicans, Speaker Ryan. And so I think that goes into it. I think it also goes into the fact that, I mean, there are a lot of studies that show fear can motivate people, and it can particularly tap into certain things. If you can find the issue that will be there that will cause people Fear can do two things. It can either motivate people to especially turn out. It can sometimes backfire to lead people to stay home in sort of this, well, mm-hmm. there's not anything I can do about it, and sort of that backlash. But a lot of times it motivates people to vote.
You know, I would this particular commercial and commercials in this vein, I question their effectiveness for the remaining sliver of the electorate that either campaign is still hoping to convince or persuade. Right. Like we saw from many of the polls that have come out in the last couple of weeks that by and large, if you're tuned into this election, you already have a sense. You know, you've already heard that dog whistle or heard the issues talked about in the language that you comport with that tells you which of the two candidates you're going for. And so to me, I hear something like this, and I think only people who would, you know, fall prey to the craziest of rumors would really be, and if there was something, you know, similar on the Democratic side, I'd say the exact same thing. I don't think this is going to be super effective.
I don't think they're trying to persuade any undecideds here. They're trying to mobilize
their people to turn out.
And it's part of a national Republican approach that we've seen throughout. I mean, we saw it in 2017 with the special election, too, to disqualify a Democratic candidate in a way by saying that they're tied to Pelosi or sure. Maxine Waters, whoever it is, with the new line from the Republicans, the mob mentality type line. And that's exactly
well, what that's it.
Yeah. If you look at what's happened, it's been fascinating to watch during the hearings and then recently with even David Perdue getting chased down in the airport or people getting chased out of restaurants or people that are in public eye not being able to sit down and have a conversation. I do think that unfortunately there are instances that show the public that, you know, it really can be nasty out there. And so I think, unfortunately, it's being used, you know, against them as well.
So we're going to post a link to the video of that TV spot on our Twitter account. But one of the things I would say about this, Greg, and one of the reasons I played it, is this really is part of the Republican scenario in the last few weeks and of the campaigns. And that is Trump is now described these people who have the nerve to protest Republican policies like going after, you know, nominating Brett Kavanaugh as the mob. This reinforces that message that Democratic and socialist individuals out there are part of a mob. And I think it is an effectively scary tactic.
Yeah. And again, it's you know, if you're Brian Kemp, you might look at your campaign strategy. You might not necessarily need to get those 4% undecided if you can wring out every vote you can, mm-hmm. if you can get a sort of presidential-like sure. turnout in those rural areas.
Well, and I think the other thing is there's been a big concern on the Republican side about complacency, right? That, hey, look, things are going well. We've gotten this stuff passed. We've gotten the Supreme Court justice confirmed. We got the big tax bill out of there. We've re-signed the new version of NAFTA. That's the USMCA. And so now... do we actually need to turn out because we've done what we want to?
All right. I got to call time. Amy, you got the last word in today's show. Amy, Howard, Jackie, Greg, thank you so much for being part of Political Rewind today. I want to make a quick program note at the end of the show. I'm really excited that on Sunday morning at 10 a.m., GPB Radio is going to air our very first radio drama. Written by an Atlanta playwright named Lee Noel. It is about the very controversial Troy Davis case in Savannah. We're going to talk a little bit more about it on Friday's show, but think about Sunday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, we will be back Friday at 2 o'clock with more Political Rewind. Hope to see you then.